Naturally, more than 90% of the activities carried out by Mortir Fakhrizadeh or are currently ongoing are not open for discussion because they are confidential.
Absolutely amazing life. Let me ask you, Mehdi, did you ever think maybe we shouldn't just insist on nuclear technology? For example, the Islamic Republic of Iran, of course, we know that there have been, you've mentioned, several nuclear scientists who have been martyred. We know the Islamic Republic has advanced technologies in various fields, from nano to stem cell technologies and others. What would you say, I mean, if Iran just gave up on its peaceful nuclear program? Why not?
There are two discussions or two dimensions here. One is the discussion of nuclear energy, the discussion of nuclear technology and nuclear knowledge. We're not only talking about nuclear energy, we're talking about nuclear technology and knowledge. Today, everyone knows that it has various applications and is among the fundamental and foundational sciences. It has diverse applications and is strategic for the country. Therefore, the country must focus on the development of nuclear science, even though it has been repeatedly emphasized, mentioned, and even examined that Iran's nuclear program is a peaceful program. Unlike many other countries, where their primary use of nuclear technology is for military purposes and violates human rights, Iran has a peaceful program. Today, good information is provided that exploitation must take place in various fields, including agriculture. Iran, like other countries, cannot and should not be deprived of using this knowledge and technology to secure the interests of its people and the residents of its cities. The second issue here is that knowledge, especially cutting-edge technologies, is empowering. Empowerment has various aspects, with the most significant being independence for powerful countries. These countries strongly resist dependence and do not want other countries to become independent. They always prefer to be in need and are inclined to maintain dependencies, reaching out to other countries.
Right. Well, your father wasn't the first scientist, as I just said, to be assassinated. And it was by the American and Israeli, of course, regimes. And these assassinations were not only to slow down, to halt the progress of individual projects, but also to send a message to others not to go into that field, not to do that. Do you think that they have been effective in sending that message to others or not?
Perhaps it was the morning after his martyrdom, a Saturday morning, when I explicitly, in the first interview I had with some television networks, wholeheartedly stated the following sentence: an arrogant regime such as Israel should fear the martyred Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as much as it feared him alive. This is a reality, at least in the events after the martyrdom, where in fact, when we complete the puzzle of the assassinations, we come to two points. Firstly, they are genuinely still afraid of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and now they fear him even more. Secondly, the very subtle message of the Supreme Leader regarding his actions and activities, illustrating how impactful one can be not only within the geographical boundaries of their own country, but far beyond. One could boldly say that he was not just an Iranian scientist, but one of the greatest scientists of his time in the Islamic world. This is an undeniable fact. Some of the work he did was closely tied to his personality, knowledge, and capabilities. Naturally, after his martyrdom, these tasks cannot continue, or if they do, they may continue with less power or force. In certain areas, given his high managerial abilities, his work on succession planning and establishing suitable structures or projects and other matters would not necessarily come to a complete halt with his martyrdom. We certainly hope that, following the experience explicit orders of the leadership, all his scientific and technical activities in all areas he was involved in will continue. I would like to mention a point related to this matter which may be relevant to your question. At the beginning of the message announced by the Supreme Leader the day after the martyrdom of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, he states, an outstanding and distinguished nuclear and defense scientist. But where he wanted to say, go and carry out his work, he did not say, go and carry out his nuclear work or go and carry out his defense work. Because the Supreme Leader knew perfectly well in which areas he was capable. Where he wanted to give orders for his activities, he used the phrase, go and pursue his work seriously. Let the officials follow up on all his scientific and technical work in all areas he was engaged in. We hope that following this strict order of the Supreme Leader, the work will proceed well. I have said this many times. Iran has shown that the youth within its borders are all capable and worthy. This soil has nurtured Soleimani. This soil has nurtured Fakhrizadeh. This soil will never be devoid of individuals like Fakhrizadeh, and God willing, the work will proceed smoothly.
Do you have any final comments? I mean, if we look at the overall situation of the Islamic Republic of Iran now and technology, are you optimistic about the future of Iran?
Exactly. In any case, over the past 40 years, we have demonstrated that we can open the greatest peaks of knowledge and technology in various fields from within ourselves and relying on our own capabilities. This includes nuclear technology, nanotechnology, stem cells, computer science, and today, in artificial intelligence and more. We have international documentation, scientific articles published by Iranian youth in emerging fields demonstrate that Iran is highly capable and performs well. We have witnessed significant growth and advancements, and we envision a bright future for our country. In the end, the point I want to make is that the assassination of martyr Fakhrizadeh and those like them is a blow not only to Iran or the Islamic world, but to human society. We lost a scientist, and they assassinated a scientist who was engaged in fundamental and foundational activities in the field of science, contributing to the beneficial development of human society. These assassinations occur to achieve malicious goals that certain groups have, not for the sake of human society or even for a specific nation. I emphasize that these assassinations occur for the sake of goals that certain groups have. Hopefully, the global community will wake up to this awareness and we will witness the confrontation with such behaviors, the result of which is a violation of the human rights of different nations and a gross violation of human rights in general.
Yes, we hope so. Thank you both for being with me, Dr. Mehdi and Dr. Hamid Fakhrizadeh. I appreciate you being with me.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back with more of the program. And thank you, viewers, for staying with us. Don't go away. There's more to the show. Stay tuned.
Now, some may ask, with so much pressure on Iran to stop its peaceful nuclear program, with all these sanctions and the sabotage of Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iran scientists and more, why doesn't the Islamic Republic just give up on its nuclear program? So let's go over a few reasons. Now, one of the major uses of nuclear energy is in the production of electricity. France, for instance, gets 70% of its electricity from nuclear energy. Now, for Iran, a country with a dry climate, using nuclear energy instead of hydropower plants is ideal, and it's dedicated at least 5 nuclear power plants to the production of electricity. This technology has many uses in the agricultural industry, from genetic modification to pest control using sterilization to water usage control and much more. Now, these are just some of the reasons that the Islamic Republic insists on making use of nuclear technology like other countries, and it has the right to do so. But it's not really about nuclear energy. Over the years, many sanctions have been placed on various other types of technology in Iran as well. The main goal is to keep the Islamic Republic of Iran from progressing, a goal that has clearly failed.
Fakhrizadeh, the Iranian nuclear physicist, vaccine developer, university professor, and more, is no longer amongst us. Now he's reached his dreams of martyrdom while fulfilling what he deemed the holy mission of working to advance his country and serving his people, the dream of giving everything he had for the worthiest cause he knew. Now, today, the same criminal entity that took the life of Fakhrizadeh continues to commit a genocide in Palestine. The same entity that accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of reaching for nuclear bombs has dropped over 40,000 tons of explosives on the Gaza Strip alone, breaking the record of American nuclear bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in death and destruction. But just as the mass murder of Palestinians has not stopped their resistance against Israeli occupation, the assassination of Iranian scientists has only made Iranians more determined to advance their country through their peaceful nuclear program. Well, Iran has certainly lost a few heroes, but the Israeli regime has lost face to millions of people who are taking to the streets to denounce its crimes across the world. And it's just as Imam Khomeini, the late leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, had said, "Go ahead and murder us. It will only awaken the masses."
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers, sisters, listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat. We are talking about helping our brothers and sisters in faith. In the previous episodes, we spoke about giving them financial support because we said there are three things we need to give to them: financial support, mental support, and emotional support. Today we want to talk about mental support. Sometimes my brother and sister in faith, they are not in need of money. Alhamdulillah, they are very well off. They have all the required financials from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But sometimes they just need someone to talk to. They need someone to express their pains and suffering to. Sometimes they might just want to seek advice from you, to share whatever in their minds with you. To them, this means the world. And to us as a human being, sometimes this is all we need. We just want someone to hear us out. So I might be financially well off, but it doesn't mean I'm happy. It doesn't mean, for example, I'm happy with my spouse, I'm happy with my children, I'm happy with my coworkers, I'm happy in life in general. I have concerns. I want to speak to somebody. I want to feel good about myself. I want to, you know, get it out of my chest. Even Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, it was said that he would go to the desert and he would put his head in the ground or in the well, in the bi'r. And then he would speak and he would let things out of his chest. Or sometimes he goes with his companions like Kumail ibn Ziyad and he would take him outside, or Abu Dharr and Ammar, and he expresses whatever in his heart with them. So a mu'min sometimes needs another mu'min just to listen to. And for example, when it comes to the believers themselves, they, in terms of education, in terms of knowledge, obviously they differ. So sometimes we need to go to the people that we can and we find them worthy of talking to. A hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, "Ittaqullah Fear Allah, وَكُونُوا إِخْوَانًا بَرَرًا, and be nice and kind and gentle brothers to one another, مُتَحَابِينَ فِي اللَّهِ, that you love one another for the sake of Allah, متواصلين, that you keep your connection with one another, متراحمين, having mercy with one another, تزاوروا, visit one another, وتلاقوا, meet one another, وتذاكروا, and talk to one another, and talk about our affairs and bring it to life. So the Imam saying, if you guys get together, meet and visit and, you know, have mercy and love and compassion towards one another and sit together and talk about us, this is a form of giving each other that mental support that is required. And when it comes to, for example, accepting the nasiha of one another, the advice of one another, he says, the Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he says in his trust to his son Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, he says to him, أَمْحَضْ أَخَاكَ النَّصِيحَ, give him the best of your advice, حَسَنَةً كَانْتٍ أَوْ قَبِيحَ وَسَاعَتُ عَلَىٰ كُلِّ حَالٍ, whether he finds this nasiha to be good or bad, just give it to him and help him in any situation. This is the sometimes the mental support that we need from one another. Let us take a short break and then we will come back.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat. So we were saying that we need to give our brothers and sisters in faith the mental support. And sometimes this mental support manifests itself in different ways. Amongst the ways that manifest itself is that I need my believing brother and sister to come to me and say to me, look, you know what? You have this and this wrong. You should fix it. This is some support that I need. Amir al-Mu'mineen and even Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, they say, أَحَبُّ أُخْوَانِ إِلَيْهِ, the most beloved of my brothers and sisters to me. Brothers and sisters in faith, obviously. مَنْ أَهْدَى إِلَيَّ عَيُوبِ, he who gifts me my faults. So a person comes to me and says to me, this is something that you say is not right. This is something that you do is not right. Maybe you should change it. So any faults in me that someone points out is actually a support. It's actually a help from that believer to me. And I should accept that with an open mind and open heart. I shouldn't say to him, well, no, how dare you say this to me? And a lot of us do this when we hear people saying things about us. And out of concern, of course, we take offense to it.
why should you take offense to it? If you think that you've done something wrong, sit down, listen, because this will help you, protect you, make you a better person. You know, I see one of my brothers in faith doing something wrong and I come and tell him, it's not because I hate him, just because I want to make him feel and look bad. Rather, I want to make him look good because he is a concern to me. So the Imam says, the most beloved of my friends, my brothers and sisters, are the ones who gift me my mistakes. Even, for example, the Ahl Bayt alayhi wasalam, they talk about when it comes to our brothers in terms of mental support, that sometimes we need to stay away from their enemies, not to take them as friends. And this is something that sometimes we do. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he says, do not take the enemy of your enemy as a friend, and in return what seems to happen is that your friend will become your enemy. And he will say to you, well, this guy is your friend, then I'm not going to be your friend. And he also said, salamullahi alayhi, as duqa'uka thalath, your friends are three. وَأَعْدَاءُكَ ثَلَاثُ, and also your enemies are three. As for your friends, your friend and your friend's friend. وَعَدُوُّ عَدُوُّكَ, and the enemy of your enemy. So these are three of your friends. Your friend, his friends, and the enemy of your enemy is also your friend. وَأَعْدَاءُكَ, as for your enemies, عَدُوُّكَ, your enemy, number one. وَعَدُوُّ صَدِيقُكَ, the enemy of your friend. And three, وَصَدِيقُ عَدُوِكَ, and the friend of your enemy is also your enemy. So, in terms of giving our friends and our brothers and sisters in faith the mental support they need, we cannot limit it to one thing. So, for example, when it comes to us helping them in any shape, way, or form, we have to do that. In terms of giving them, for example, the adequate advice, also we are required to do so. When it comes to even supporting them in not being enemies with their enemies, this is something that we also need to do. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. This is Muhammad Jawad, the host of the program Islamic Laws, with our guest speaker, Sheikh Javed, as always. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. My pleasure.
We are going to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting. Sheikh Javid, let's discuss puberty.
All right? Sure.
Very important. Maybe there are individuals who have just come of age and they have no idea, no clue about the age of legal responsibility. They don't know when to start their rituals, their religious services, including fasting. When should the boys and girls start fasting?
Well, that's a pretty question, a good question, and it's one of the most frequently asked questions. It is generally said that girls attain puberty when they complete 9 lunar years. So 9 lunar years is equal to 8 years and 8 months and 25 days. But when it comes to the boys, of course, there are 3 signs through which puberty is established.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of them is that they should complete 15 lunar years. Now, 15 lunar years, 15 lunar years is
for the boys.
Yeah, for the boys, is equal to 14 years and 6 months and 17 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
in solar calendar.
In terms of solar calendar. Okay, so this is one of the signs. And then the second sign for the boys is ejaculation of semen. Okay, if they happen to ejaculate at night, or at any time, of course, then that sign is established, and he should consider himself as someone who has hit puberty.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's
is actually what the youngsters call wet dreams.
Wet dreams, yes. Yeah, wet dreams. Or let's say there's another also term, I wish I remembered it. Okay, anyhow. Nightfall, they call it also nightfall. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then there's a third sign, and that is the growing of coarse hair around the genital area.
Right.
If there is hair, and that's rough, coarse hair around the genital area, that's another sign for a sign of puberty. And the one who sees one of these signs must actually begin practicing religion, and he should consider himself as someone who has attained the age of legal responsibility. He should actually consider himself as someone who is adult and must follow the rules of the religion according to what the religious scholars have prescribed and mentioned in their books, which is called Tawzi' al-Masail, or the Book of Islamic Laws.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. I have a very relevant question, but we have to leave it up to the next portion of this episode. Stay with us. Inshallah, we'll come back after the break and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan. بالقرآن حل ليالنا بالقيام أهلا أهلا بالصيام.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the blessed month of Ramadan. Sheikh Javid, before the break, you mentioned that there are 3 signs that appear on a boy, basically.
Yes.
And if any boy, any typical boy, reaches puberty, he would notice these signs, right?
Yes.
So the question is, should, you know, all of these signs be present for the boy to come to the realization that he has reached puberty and now is the time for him to start fasting? Or just one of them is sufficient?
That's a good question. Well, it is not necessary for all these three signs to appear concurrently.
Mm-hmm.
If one of these signs appears, the boy should consider himself as pubescent, as adult, and of course maybe he may not have completed 15 lunar years.
Mm.
He might be 13 years old, maybe 14 years old, or even younger, and one of these signs might appear. And this time around, actually, we do know that I have myself come across people, you very young boys who are 13 years old, but they have beard on their faces. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
that means they have actually attained mm-hmm. puberty.
I see.
So a boy might be 13 years old, and he might be he is adult. He has hit puberty. He should not wait for two more years to complete 15 lunar years. That's yes. not a valid excuse.
Mm.
He should start. Actually, it is the duty of the parents to remind or to educate their children to start fasting, because they have they have beard on their faces.
Mm-hmm, I see.
Yeah.
You talked about these three signs for a boy when he has reached puberty. But what about the girls? Do we have the same kind of or similar signs appearing on a girl for the girl to realize that this is her puberty?
Well, when it comes to girls, of course, the girls, there's only one sign for the girls. The religious authorities have said that, of course, in recent years, we see that some religious scholars have said that, okay, a girl might attain puberty at a later period. Maybe she might be 12 years or 13 years old. But anyhow, when it comes to the opinion of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and even Ayatollah Sistani, we see that they have said that a girl attains the age of puberty and the age of legal responsibility at the completion of 9 lunar years. So there's no second or third sign to be to appear on her, so that she may consider as a criterion for establishing puberty.
Ah, I see. And what about the other signs, like the pubic hair, for example?
No. There's no such sign for girls.
Uh huh. I see. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws touching on Ramadan and fasting with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, a young girl has reached the age of religious or Shari'i puberty. However, we all know that some of the girls are not able, in fact, to serve or give the services, the religious services, or offer their, for example, fasting, because of their weak condition
stamina
or constitution,
yes.
Right? And they aren't able to perform the qada even of their fasting, for example, the next year.
Yeah.
All right? Or up until the next Ramadan, for example. So, how should these girls go about religious issues?
And that's a good question. Well, the obligation of fasting or performing the qada for the missed fast is not removed. First of all, it is necessary to note that a person who, a girl, as you said, is not able to observe fast during the month of Ramadan because of the hot weather or because of the physical fitness that she lacks, a weak body, frail body,
mm-hmm.
and so she cannot fast, and of course that means she must not fast in that condition because she is unable to fast.
Yes,
but it doesn't mean that she's not supposed to give the qada.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when the weather is hot, okay, she is not supposed to fast. But when the days are shorter, especially in the winter season, when the days are short, she must observe the qaza of the fast. And of course, the qaza of the missed days of fasting in Ramadan will remain obligatory for her.
If she's not even able to do the qaza, then would the kafara be compulsory for her?
Well, there's no kafara, because kafara is when you deliberately do an act, violate.
No, I mean that when you aren't able to fast because of your medical condition, for example.
Yes.
Then.
That is something else, okay? When, for example, you are ill, you're not supposed to fast because if it
exactly.
is feared.
Yes.
If it is feared that fasting might harm your
right.
health and may even aggravate your condition.
Uh-huh, your situation.
Yeah,
yes.
your situation. Then it's not permissible to fast. But in that case, you have to give 750 grams of foodstuff as a fidya.
Fidya right.
to the poor.
Right.
And, of course, you have to see and wait. Wait and see. Wait and see whether, for example, you are going to recover within the,
uh-huh.
for example, 11 months coming
right.
after the month of Ramadan or
right.
not. If you happen to recover, then it is necessary to give the qada, to observe the fast of those missed days. And if you do not recover at all and you remain ill, and remain in a severe condition, of course, and it's difficult for you to fast, then fasting is waived, actually. You are not supposed to fast, and only that fidya that you give is sufficient.
I see. Thank you very much, Shabi. And thank you, my dear listeners, for joining us, joining your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the month of Ramadan. With me, the host of this program, we bid you farewell, and wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. 'Cause Ramadan is here. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy.
On June 18, 1994, when Francisco Oscar Lamolina, the referee of the opening game of the World Cup, blew into the whistle, over 77,000 spectators were shouting in jeers at Pontiac Silverdome Stadium in Detroit. It was the first time that the World Cup was being held in the U.S. For a month, all eyes all over the world were fixated at the event. The shining stars of the world of football, like Romario, Roberto Baggio, Hristo Stoichkov, and Gheorghe Hagi, filled the stadiums to the brim. With every goal, yellow or red cards, the stadiums were in uproar, like the day when Nigeria thrashed Bulgaria with three goals and the fans of the team were madly shouting out of joy. People who had traveled thousands of miles from Africa so they could watch the games up close. Those days were good days for the people in Africa, but not for all the residents of the continent. Right at the time when people across the world were glued to their television sets to watch Nigeria's exhilarating display of skills, in a part of Africa, one of the most brutal genocide in the history of mankind was underway. The Tutsi and Hutu tribes in Rwanda were up in arms against each other. In 100 days, 1 million people, nearly 20% of the population of the country, were killed. The Hutus that had control over the government killed so many people from ethnic Tutsis that the tribe lost 75% of its population. The genocide eventually stopped after the UN intervention, but it proved that death in Africa is an ordinary thing that can take place. However, the genocide in Rwanda wasn't the largest massacre Africa was witnessing. In the 60s, amid the French occupation of Algeria, over 1.5 million people died in the country within a span of 2 years only for asking for independence. If you think it was the bloodiest incident in Africa, you'd better go through the history of Belgium, a small country that perks in Western Europe and is shown in a light of democracy and freedom these days. But in the not-too-distant past, it experienced one of the most horrifying governments in history. Leopold II, the former Belgian king, who ruled over the country from 1865 to 1909, occupied the Congo in Africa. During the 44 years of occupation, he slaughtered over 10 million people in the Central African country. Yet, despite the high number of killing, Leopold II is not on top of the list of the biggest murderers in history. As it was announced in the 60s and 70s, the biggest and scariest murderer in Africa, unlike what the majority of the people in the world imagine, was a woman. The number of the people this woman put to death is higher than the number of the people killed by Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, and even Genghis Khan put together. Even higher than the number of the people who were killed during the bombing of Dresden in Germany, and the victims of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear bombing. Apparently, Rachel Carson is the biggest murderer in history, and yet nobody was aware for a long time. Everyone admired Carson for being a nice human being and a great author, and also for her role as an environmental activist. She has been praised in numerous books, articles, and reports, but in the end, the mask was removed from her face. They said that the woman who had a charming smile on her face in all of the pictures and the only thing she cared about was nature was behind the death of millions of people in Africa. The deaths happened after she genetically modified mosquitoes. If we take a look at history, we'll find out that Rachel Carson's life in many ways had striking similarity with major criminals throughout history, like Hitler, who used to paint pictures when he was a young man, or Stalin, who was a choir singer. Carson was into art, literature, and poetry. She was born in Pennsylvania and graduated from Johns Hopkins University in 1932. After getting a degree in zoology, she started her career as a journalist. 15 years later, she displayed so much talent and skills in the field of aquatic creatures that she supervised all publications in this field. During those years, she tried books besides working as a journalist. Her books are on environment and the seas, which gained Carson fame. She resigned from all of her posts in 1952, so she could concentrate mainly on writing books. The most important book she wrote in that period was her autobiography. The US media, as well as many chemists and physicians, say the book changed the fate of millions of people in African and many other parts of the world. Carson's name turned into the nightmare of people who were grappling with malaria.
In Africa and Asia, the mosquito is a mass killer. More than 2 million people die every year from malaria, which mosquitoes transmit.
In 1962, Carson's Silent Spring was published. In her book, she has talked about the detrimental health hazards on pesticides on food and agricultural products, and that the widespread use of DDT helps the poisonous substance permeate into plants and remain in their texture for a long time and cause disease. They say the publication of the book and raising such issues banned the use of DDT across the world, including in Africa. But the ban in Africa led to the emergence of an old disease across the continent. Back then, many chemists criticized Carson for her theory and claimed it was basically unfounded.
In Miss Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, are gross distortions of the actual facts, completely unsupported by scientific experimental evidence and general practical experience in the field. A suggestion that pesticides are in fact biocides destroying all life is obviously absurd in the light of the fact that without selective biological activity, these compounds would be completely useless.
Based on figures and documents proposed by Dr. Gordon Edwards, an entomologist at the University of San Jose in California, stated in his paper that the elimination of DDT helped the mosquitoes that transit malaria to reproduce without any barriers. In a few years, the population of the mosquitoes grew so large that millions of Africans fell victim to the disease and lost their lives. According to Edwards in an article titled Bias, Misinformation, Half-Truth, published in 1992 in the Science and Technology magazine, The Silent Spring has been one of the deadliest books in history as it sent millions of people in Africa to their death. Some people put the number of fatalities at about 50 million people, larger than the number of the casualties in the Second World War. DDT was first synthesized in 1874 by Othmar Zeidler, but insecticidal properties were not identified until World War II. But from 1939, it was widely used by soldiers on farms to fight off lice and typhus. Major chemical companies produced millions of tons of DDT every year and earned whopping amounts of profits. So it was only natural that the companies were outraged over the ban imposed on production and sales of DDT. Therefore, when Rachel Carson published her book, they spent about $250,000 to debunk her claims.
Measures which research laboriously has developed.
In the media, they called her a radical, hysterical spinster who only keeps cats and hates genetics. It was at that time when Carson was introduced as the biggest criminal in history who caused the deaths of millions of people. Even today, the claim continues to be circulated by some people, but the reality is Rachel Carson was never a criminal or murderer. In fact, the ban on consumption of DDT has nothing to do with her. In fact, 5 years before Carson's Silent Spring was published, the United States Environmental Protection Agency reached the conclusion that using DDT has detrimental effects on humans' health.
A government-backed scientific panel today reported that pesticides may indeed represent a grave threat to mankind.
The average American already has more DDT in his body than is permitted in the meat and fish that we eat. It does not go away, it accumulates, and it passes to babies through their mother's milk.
So the consumption of chemical substance sharply declined from 1957 to 1967, and in 1979, it was completely banned. At that time, it was revealed that DDT is not effective in killing malaria because they quickly adapt themselves to the insecticides. In fact, now everyone knows that Carson and malaria are irrelevant. But powerful businesses and political lobbies in the 60s and 70s grilled the scientists for her studies, and many people detested her. It has happened many times through history. Rachel Carson is only one example of politicizing science.
We have heard a great deal about their safety, but very little about the hazards, very little about the failures, the inefficiencies. And yet the public was being asked to accept these chemicals, was being asked to acquiesce in their use, and did not have the whole picture. So I set about to remedy the balance there.
In 1898, German medical student Hermann Rottmann announced that tobacco causes infection and tumor in the lungs. Laborers at tobacco fields were exposed to the highest risk. He continued to hold to the wrong belief until 1912, when some doctors tied lung diseases to smoking cigarettes. In the 1920s, when lung cancer was being identified, it was attributed to various agents like asphalt and the effects of poisonous gases in World War I. Smoking cigarettes did not have an outstanding place on the list. But in 1939, Hermann Müller in the Cologne University in Germany studied 86 patients with lung cancer and publicly announced the relationship between smoking and the disease. The idea was soon approved by the scientists in the US and Britain, as well as the American Cancer Society. The news was a massive shock to the tobacco industry all over the world, and their shares at the stock markets plunged. Six major cigarette-producing companies decided to find a way out of the crisis. On December 14, 1953, the directors of the companies gathered in the Hotel Plaza in Manhattan and told the reporters that the alleged link between smoking and lung cancer needs further scientific research. They announced that the claim that cigarette is a carcinogen is unfounded, and there are no scientific proof to back the claim. Those who stood up against tobacco companies would face harsh reactions from the companies and the scientists affiliated with the companies.
4 packs of cigarettes a day. I am 55. Yeah! You, wait a second. Tell me if I don't look 20 years younger than this.
These people were on many radio and television shows. Their message to the audience was, "We're not sure if smoking cigarettes can cause cancer." In fact, the doubt ruled the minds of the people. This is known as the trade of doubt.
This is America today. The pace fast, the competition great. We live with more tension, more emotion, more concern about our health, more everything than ever before.
In 1979, a promotional video footage named "Smoking and Health, The Need to Know" was made and broadcast by tobacco companies. The video was played for hundreds of thousands of Americans. During the screening time and after that, the audience was posed with some questions. They were asked, "Is it likely that the concerns raised over smoking and the health hazards are wrong?" A year after the survey, they achieved unbelievable results. There was a 17% decline in the number of those who already believed that smoking can cause cancer. It nosedived to 59% from 76%. The survey was conducted in other countries like Britain and the Netherlands. In the 1980s, Philip Morris spent millions of dollars to persuade the people in the UK that they should not worry about secondhand smoking. Meanwhile, a study conducted in the Netherlands in 2011 showed that 61% of the people in the country believe that smoking poses no threats to non-smokers, while throughout these years, many doctors and scientists have tried to prove to the people that smoking, cigarettes and nicotine can be very hazardous and can lead to many diseases like lung cancer. They publish different kinds of figures to push back those who capitalize on doubt. But those who were on the other side of the story, namely tobacco factories and their affiliated scientists, wielded huge power. Now it has come to light that the scientists knew for decades that cigarettes and its compounds are very hazardous for human body. The documents leaked in the 1980s and 1990s by some tobacco company staff revealed that the owners of the companies had known as an established fact from the 1950s that smoking can cause cancer. In one of these documents dated 1953, Claude Thigault, one of the scientific advisors of Camel Tobacco Company, wrote to his director that the tobacco in cigarettes is one of the main factors behind lung cancer, and added that there is a direct correlation between smoking and lung cancer. A decade before that, Emma Harris Palmer, the head of the research center of Lord Yard, acknowledged that there is ample evidence to prove the link between smoking and lung cancer.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat